You know, within recent years, I've devoted a good many stories to the people you and I love so much. They choose to call themselves senior citizens. They're beautiful to look at. They're late 70s, early 80s and 90s. We might have some of them in the audience. I can't see from here, but I imagine there are a few. And I look forward to my annual visits to Miami Beach, where, of course, we find mostly the folks of my extraction. The rest of you send your people to St. Petersburg. Used to be Fort Lauderdale till we moved in with the condominiums. It's not a dirty word, it's an apartment. Condominiums. But you know, extraction has nothing to do with it. You go down to Washington Avenue and Lincoln Road. Watch a group of these beautiful little people standing on a corner waiting for the traffic light to change. You'll notice they never cross when it's green. At that age, I guess they like to live dangerously. What else is left? I know. Here's a little man in his late 70s, stepped off the curb. He was hit by a car. Thank goodness there was a policeman handy. They sent for an ambulance. Lift him into the ambulance. The doctor covered him with three or four blankets, pillows at his feet, pillows at his head. And the doctor leaned over and asked, "Are you comfortable?" He says, "Thank God I make a good living." And for purposes of this next story, permit me a wee bit of poetic license. This is probably not true. I say that actuaries associated with insurance companies have discovered that people live much longer lives on the Lower East Side of New York than they do anywhere else in the nation. And they sent a group of men down there to talk to them. They had a little fellow, 94 years of age, plied him with many, many questions, finally concluded by saying, "Since you lived here all of these years, in your opinion, sir, and we value it highly, what would you say the death rate is in this area?" Well, he said, "Gentlemen, in mine opinion, and I value that you value it highly, I would say that the death rate is one to a person." And nothing is funnier than the truth. And I swear to you, this is true, because it happened right here in Miami Beach last winter while I was at the Dover. A gentleman I would judge to be somewhere in his 50s told me a true story about his father, who unfortunately is a widower. Now, the son is in good shape financially, and he provides his dad with a lovely two-room suite at the Dover, and he visits with him almost every night. And this one evening, the son opened the door to the suite. Here sat his father watching television. He says, "What are you watching, Pop?" He says, "Basketball." He says, "What's the score?" He says, "86-82. He says, "Who's winning?" He says, "86. Nothing is funnier than the truth. You sons and daughters deserve a great deal of credit because you add many years to their lives. And these two little women I'm thinking of, they're pretty much like their daughters, because on lovely days, you'll find them on the white sand, the blue-green waters. They love that. And yet on cloudy days, again, they're pretty much like you daughters, because on cloudy days, they love to go shopping by Lincoln Road. You and I know it as Lincoln Road. They call it Lincoln Road. They can't read or write English, but they know this, that if you stand on the corner of Lower Collins Avenue, pretty soon a bus will come along. Into the bus they'll go, nothing to worry about, because eventually the driver will call out, "Lincoln Road!" And out they'll go. Well, there they stand on the corner, a cloudy January the 15th, the opening day of the Hialeah Racetrack. Nothing to worry about. Along comes a bus. It happens to be Hialeah bus. But to them, a bus is a bus. In they go. Nothing to worry about. They get into conversation. "How's your daughter? Did your son send her out to check?" All the way out to Hialeah. Everybody gets off. They follow along. One says, "What the hell is this? I didn't was you before. Must be a new development by Mars Landsberg." The other one says, "Must be a zoo." All I could see is horses and ducks with long necks. Suddenly one discovers something. She says, Sally, did I just find out if you put up money, you could win. They each chip in a dollar. They buy a $2 mutual ticket. The race is run. The horse loses. One begins bemoaning her fate, and the other one says, you know, we lucky girls that we lost. Tell the truth. What the hell would we do with a horse? Oh, a thought just popped into my mind. There's nothing to stop it. Two bookmakers are leaving church after services. They get out into the street. One slaps the other one in a kisser. He says, you jerk, it's hallelujah, not hallelujah. Or as it is said further down, hallelujah. Not long ago, you may remember, on one of Mr. Ed Sullivan's shows, I told of two adorable little women in their 80s. And one says, Jenny, if you would find in the street $1 million, what you would do with it? She says, I'll tell you the truth, if it belonged to a poor person, I would give it back. Do you remember an attitude your mother would assume when you were a little one and you did something naughty? She never opened her mouth. She just stood there and looked at you, and you thought to yourself, I didn't do it. But if she doesn't tell Papa when he comes home tonight, I'll never do it again. Well, it's only the attitude I wanted you to see. Because this may be applied to a little woman 85 years of age who'd had some work done to the dentist. And about 3 days after the work was completed, she walked back into his office. He was a young man. She stepped up to him quite brazenly, placed her hands on her hips. You would assume he could have been her grandson for her attitude. She says, you're a dentist, huh? You know I got different teeth. Oh, I'm sure you went to college. You got what they call graduate. They gave you a piece of paper, what they call a diploma. So now you know I got different teeth. You know the tea that you made me? It's no goddamn good. They don't fit. Well, there's nothing unusual about that, my dear. That's happened before. Let's take a bite test. He took the necessary bite test. It seems quite all right to me. He said, I don't care if it seems to you. It's not your teeth. It's mine teeth. You made them. It's no goddamn good. They don't fit. Well, he said, do you have any trouble eating? She says, thanks to goodness, I got a healthy stomach. I eat two very fine meals every day, sometimes in the afternoon, crackers and jelly with tea. But he asked me questions that don't fit. When he says, you're beginning to insult my intelligence. You tell me they feel comfortable. You enjoy three healthy meals every day, yet you persist in telling me they don't fit. She says, who the hell do you hollering? You know, you really are joking. I'm not talking about a mouth that don't fit in the glass. I want you to hear another true story about a very dear friend of mine in New York who happens to be one of the nation's top diagnosticians. He told me of a little woman in her 80s who came to him for an examination. He said, be good enough to disrobe. I'll be back in a few minutes. I want to see another patient in the next office. When he got back, as yet she hadn't taken her things off. And he got the impression that she didn't understand English. And since he spoke Yiddish as well, he said the very same thing in Yiddish. Take your things off, please. She's in her 80s, mind you, very sheepish. She hung her head. She says, doctor, you get undressed first. Because this is the season of the year that prompts this story. And unless I'm here at this time of year, I never talk about it. You must hear another true story that happened right here at this very time of year. You know what happens Christmas and New Year's. You wonderful mothers and fathers bring the youngsters along. It's a great vacation. And then, of course, the town jams up. There's no place to stay. There are no rooms to be had for love nor money. I've known of some people who've had to sleep in automobiles. It's been that crowded. However, despite that, the moment the New Year holiday is finished, everybody wants to leave here on the same day, on the same plane, in the same seat. You know that's not going to happen. It took people 2 to 3 weeks to get down here. And if you're ever out at the airport, as I've been on occasion, you'll hear fathers pleading with the ticket agents at the respective airlines. Not for me. My business stinks. I could stay. But for the kids, they got to go back to school. You want them to get love back? Do you want to have on your conscience on account of you, my children grow up to be dopes? Take my son as a genius. Genius. Goes to Ham High Tea. You know, Mr. Chu. Don't give me a ticket, give him. I'll sit in his lap. Now, it's reasonable to assume that I should be in a pretty fair position to understand most of the language spoken in this area. I'm going to show you how wrong I can be. In the lower lobby of the Dovo, I heard a fellow say to another, "Where do you living?" Now, most of you think you understand that? I thought I did. Because in answer to that question, "Where do you living?" the other guy says, "If I could get a reservation on a plane, I'm leaving Thursday." Well, I want you now to hear about a man entertaining a lovely lady in her one-room suite. When suddenly there's a knock at the door, she says, "My God, my husband." He says, "You never told me you were married." "This is no time to argue. Get out of here." Well, he says, "Where can I hide?" She says, "Get out of here. I don't care. Hang out the window." Believe it or not, there he is hanging out the window by his fingers. Now, he's telling a friend of this experience. He says, "In came the husband, took out a pocket knife, jabbed it under my fingernails. Hurt like hell." Well, he says, "That must have made you mad." He says, "It didn't make me mad." Then he took a jar of molasses and dumped it over my head. Well, he says, "Surely that..." He said, "No, that didn't make me mad." Then he ripped open a pillow and dumped the feathers all over. You can imagine what I looked like, hanging like a kachki. Well, he says, "Of course..." He said, "No, that didn't make me mad, but when I looked down and saw I was only 3 feet from the ground, that made me mad." This thing just popped into my mind. It's about two lovely little women in their middle 40s who've known each other since they were little bitty kids. They've always lived in the same community. They are the dearest of friends. Sisters couldn't be closer. They would tell each other things they wouldn't dare tell anyone else. Now they're married, they have families, and they still live in the very same communities. And every morning when the kids are off to school, you'll find them in each other's homes over a cup of coffee. Remember now, one would never tell anyone else what she would tell her girlfriend, the dearest of friends. And this one morning she comes and she says, "Arnie, oh, I don't know how to tell you. It's a terrible thing. I heard about it, that it happens to people, but to me it should happen. If I could live with a thing like this..." She says, "I'm having an affair." The other one says, "So who's the caterer?" And you remember I used to do a story about a man who went into a seafood restaurant, ordered a lobster. The waiter brought it, placed it before him. He looked at it a moment, looked back up at the waiter. "Psst, buddy. Psst, buddy. The waiter who owns property." Waiter walked up to him and says, "To who the hell do you pusting coming?" Customer says, "What did you say to me?" He says, "What did you order?" He says, "What the hell is it, a riddle?" Waiter says, "You ordered the lobster and that's is it." Customer says, "I know what's is it. This I'm not gonna eat it. It's only got one claw. C-L-A-double, a claw." Waiter says, "There's nothing unusual. I've served thousands lobsters with only one claw." Customer says, "It happens I'm not interested in your accomplishments. I don't eat no crippled lobsters." Waiter says he's not a cripple. He was in a fight. What do you expect me to do? He's a jerk. Bring me the winner. Which one are you laughing at? God love you. There's a little man in the city of New York all of us in show business adore. This is one of the most beautiful little men that ever lived. He owns the stage delicatessen, Little Max Asness. It's on 7th Avenue between 53rd and 54th Streets. We go there. He's a great host, has a great sense of humor. I was having breakfast at the stage delicatessen. Little Max told me he had a waiter one time. He aided his guts. Just the way he said, I yated his guts. So I gave him a $2 raise, and the next week I fired him. So the waiter came to me and says, I thought you liked me, you gave me a raise. He says, I ate your guts. I only gave you a raise, you should lose a better job. And let me tell you about a Martian. We don't know whether there is life on Mars or not. Even the scientists don't know. It's reasonable to assume that a Martian could be walking around on the street. A fellow walked up to him and said, you're a Martian, aren't you? He said, yeah. He said, do they all look like you? He says, uh-huh. Do they all have googly eyes? He says, yeah. Do they all have antennas poked out of their heads? He says, uh-huh. Do they all wear little round hats? He said, no, only the Orthodox. And this is a neighbor of that Martian who came down in his flying saucer, landed on 53rd Street and 7th Avenue. And as the saucer landed, he got a flat in his little bitty tire. He tried to take off, couldn't gain the necessary momentum. He had no spare. He was from South Mars. He got onto the flying saucer, began looking in store windows for a place to pick up a little bitty tire for the little bitty wheel. Got to the stage delicatessen with a bunch of bagels hanging in the window. He's a hot damn, that's one of them tires. He went in, he saw little Max, he says, I want to buy one of them tires. Max says, you're crazy. It's not a tire, that's a bagel. The Martian says, what the hell's a bagel? He says, I'll let you to taste. The Martian bit into it, he said, you know, that would be good with cream cheese and lox. You know, coming out of the commercial world as I do, you can readily understand why it is I love to repeat a typical business-type story. Incidentally, one which may be applied to any industry anywhere in the nation. But of course, having been so close to the garment industry and the textile world for so many, many years, I say it happened there. 25 years of his life, this little man found it possible to arrive for work every morning at 9 o'clock. Just as the good Lord made the day, he walked in for his work at 9 a.m, you could set your watch by his appearance. And suddenly one morning, after all these 25 years of punctual 9 o'clock appearances, he walked in at 10. Two black eyes, bloody nose, ear hanging, lip torn, clothes ripped and disheveled. Boy says, what the hell happened to you? He says, oh, fell down all flight stairs, almost got killed. The boss says, so this took an hour? You know, I had a boss like that once. And speaking of the dress industry, you're so nice, I can't resist telling you about two partners. Things are rough. They decide to split. They cut it right down the middle. One stays in the dress industry, the other one goes out to California with what's left of his money. Winds up in the motion picture business. Believe it or not, in a year, he's a fantastic tycoon. Now his former partner, the dress man, goes to visit with him, walks into a magnificent office, sumptuous, the last word in elegance. His former partner, feet up on the desk, a cigar a mile long. He says, you look to me like a big shot in pictures. He says, you got them tootin'. I only make epics. If the picture not gonna cost me $100 million, I don't start up with it. I use maybe 100,000 extras a day. She says, 100,000 extras? What can it be? Well, he says, I make vestments. I use maybe 50,000 Indians, 50,000 cowboys. Cowboys. He says, how much you pay him a day? He says, $100 a day. He said, you're a cock-a-liar. I said, honest to God. $100 a day, $100,000 next day. How could you afford it? He says, we use real bullets. You ladies are so pretty. I think with all of the beauty, you will admit, however, that when a man becomes successful in the business world, he must of necessity have a hobby. He must. It's obvious here, around the Eden Rock. You let him enjoy himself. He has hobbies. He likes to play cards, this, that, the other thing. Now, here are two tremendously successful businessmen. As a hobby, they don't play golf anymore. It's too many holes. You know, holes. Jim Rome, they don't need the money. Girls, it's here. I know. But a new hobby has developed within recent years. You read about it in all of your fine magazines. Safari in Africa. Hunting wild animals. Hunting. In Africa yet. And wild ones. And here are these two guys. Upton, I'd have been afraid for my chihuahua puppy. Now they're going in Africa hunting wild animals. You see them now with the pith helmets, the sand brown belts, the knives, the guns, all the equipment in darkest Africa stalking wild game. One guy over there, this guy, they're going to surround him. God forbid they should see something. Suddenly this fellow feels something nudging him from behind. He knows he's not in Greece. Now he's afraid to turn around, but he doesn't want to admit it. So he calls to his friend, Mars. Mars. He says, I can't turn around. I got a kink in my neck. What's pushing me? A tiger? It's a leopard. Mars says, what the hell are you asking me? I'm not a furrier. I must tell you about the youngster born to one of the nation's wealthiest families. At an early age, he begins to show a feeling for the world of opera. With all of that wealth behind him, it's made possible for him to have the finest in voice, culture, elocution, everything to make for a great career in the event he shows promise. Well, believe it or not, when he gains his maturity, he's begun to carve a niche for himself in the world of operatic music, beautiful voice. And as a result, he's invited to sing at La Scala in Milan. Now, the opera world knows this to be the truth, and I'm sure you do. There is no opera audience anywhere in the world quite like the one you'll find at La Scala, if for no other reason than that they are born, they live, and they die with the opera. They'll beg, borrow, and steal to get entrance to the opera house. They go to the opera to listen. You might come to Milan with a fantastic reputation 2 minutes after you've opened your mouth. That audience knows whether you can sing or whether you're a fake. Now, the opera this particular evening is I Pagliacci and the aria Veste di Giubba. And this young man pours his heart and soul into the aria, so much so that when he finishes, the entire audience rises as if one. Encore, you must sing again. And he does. When he finishes it for the second time, again, you must sing. This happens 8 times. They're screaming for the 9th encore. He walks to the footlights and says, ladies and gentlemen, little do you realize what a thrill it is to be accepted at La Scala as you've received me. Please let the opera continue. You know I've already sung the aria 8 times. What do you expect of me? A little Italian man from the top balcony screamed down at me, said, you dirty son of Mangoni, you gonna sing that goddamn thing until you get it right. You know, night after night, no matter where I go, just such nice people as you see fit to bring the youngsters, and I like that. That's a great compliment. It means, of course, that I'm using good taste, and that's why I usually like to keep it. I'm no prude. I know all the other jokes. I sold goods for 25 years. Let me tell you a story I've been associated with for many, many years, about the adorable little 8-year-old girl, quite like the one you might have in your very own heart, who walked into a bakery shop and said to the baker, My mommy found a fly in a raisin bread. She said, bring back the fly, I'll give you a raisin. And here's an adorable little 5-year-old who says to his little boyfriend, my father could beat your father. He says, big deal, so can my mother. And let me tell you about a little bitty guy in kindergarten. All day long, he walks around the classroom. My mommy gonna have a baby. My mommy gonna have a baby. She can't make him quit. She locks him in the closet. Mommy gonna have a baby. Put him in a corner with a dunce cap. Mommy gonna have a baby. Well, the following afternoon, and some of you little mothers in our audience have done this, and I've seen it happen. His little mother, a youngster, took his little hand and put it on her tummy, and he felt the movement of the unborn child. Well, for the next 2 days in class, he didn't open his mouth. The teacher began to wonder about this. She said, Johnny, what about the baby? She said, I think my mommy ate it. And ladies and gentlemen, yesterday I was paid a visit by one of the nation's truly fine comedy minds, Little Maury Amsterdam. I want you to hear a couple of the stories he gave me. Two gentlemen out on the beach here. And one says, you know, the way they got figured out with the astronauts, they don't start up to send them until they're sure that they're going to come back. So it's out of safety. So what the hell we have to worry from them? We got a few dollars. We'll invest in a capsule. You know, a capsule. And we'll go to the sun. They're going to the moon. What the hell we need with them? We'll go to the sun. We'll take pictures. We'll buy property. The other guy says, what, are you crazy? You'll come within 100,000 miles from the sun. It's so hot, it'll melt the capsule. And then we're dead. The other guy says, so we'll go at night. I want you to hear about a little woman in her 80s who went to the doctor. She says, I want you to give me a prescription for birth control pills. He says, I've heard of everything. You're 87 years old. What do you want for those? She says, I didn't ask you no questions. I'm going to pay for the visit. Give me the prescription. So he gave it to her. 2 months later, he met her on the street. How are the pills working? She says, I'm sleeping like a baby. He says, they're not sleeping pills. What in the world? What do you do with them? She says, I tell you the truth. In the morning when I wake up, I have breakfast with my grandchild. When she's not looking, I put 2 pills in her orange juice. I sleep like a baby. Which reminds me of the little woman in her 80s who meets the young doctor. He says, how do you feel, my dear? She says, I tell you the truth. Hurts me the arthritis, with the bursitis, with the pressure, and the pain and the crisis. And the stomach is not 100%. He says, why don't you come to my office to see me? She says, maybe next week when I'll feel better. You watch television as much as I do, I'm sure. And it's for that reason I want you to hear a little something that will become strangely familiar to you in a moment. Picture, if you will, a tall high on some Texan. A high on some Texan. Fine-looking guy. With a 10-gallon hat, the beautiful boots, the tight-fitting jacket with the patched pockets, the embroidered darts running up the back. Finds himself on the Lower East Side of New York. A predominantly Jewish neighborhood. He's obviously lost. Obviously. He walks up to the little Jewish peddler with a push cart and he says, can y'all tell me where I am? And the little guy says, brother, you're not in Marlboro country. Not long ago in Vegas, an FBI man told me a story of a bank robber who had stolen $500,000. Now, they never found the money, but they caught up with this guy and put him in jail. A week later, he got a letter from his wife. Dear John, we're going to plow up the backyard and plant potatoes. He sent back a letter, don't plow up the backyard. A couple of days later, he got a letter, the FBI was here and plowed up the backyard. He sent back a letter, now you can plant potatoes. Earlier this evening, a lady reminded me of a story I did years and years ago. Haven't done it in many years. About the little woman who went to the butcher shop. She said to the butcher, Marty, today, if you'll be so kindly, I feel like Tavish will give me 6 lamb chops. So how much gonna cost? Butcher says, for you? For you, $2 a pound. She says, for who? She said, you must be cockeyed drunk. I could get across the street by Schwartz, the butcher, for $1.40. He says, who the hell sent for you? Go by Schwartz. She says, he ain't got any. He says, if I wouldn't have any, I'd give you $1.25. And for you little ladies, here's a woman who says to another, look at your hair, for God's sake. Look how streaky. You know streaky? S-T-R-E-A-K-Y, streaky. She says, I bet you didn't shampoo already since God knows. In fact, it looks like a wick. The other one says, it happens, my dear friend, it is a wick. And the first one says, you know, you can't tell. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the George Washington Bridge, the bridge that goes from New York to Jersey. And picture a little guy driving a horse and wagon across the bridge. When he gets to the toll gate, the man at the gate says, 50 cents, please. He says, I thought it's only for automobiles, 50 cents. He says, no, any vehicle. No, he says, well, listen, what are you going to do? So he backed up. Went about 1/4 mile back, unhitched the horse, put him in the wagon, and I pulled the wagon to the toll gate. The guy says, 50 cents, please. He says, talk to the driver. Let me tell you about a businessman who, in filing his income tax return, deducted $500 as a bad debt because he claimed he'd loaned his partner $500 and he'd never gotten it back. Well, eventually, it's called down to the Internal Revenue Service. And the revenue agent says, there's got to be something wrong here, mister, because your partner was here with 5 witnesses who've testified they saw him give you back the $500. He says, is that so? Well, I'm going to show you what a goddamn liar is my partner. I never loaned it to him. And this fellow wrote a letter to the Internal Revenue Service saying, on my 1962 return, I cheated. I've had a guilty conscience ever since and haven't been able to sleep. Enclosed, you'll find my check in the amount of $500, and if I still can't sleep, I'll send you the ballot. I must tell you, a few months ago, in New York, I was privileged to entertain 3,500 ladies and gentlemen representing the National Association of Insurance Agents. This is true. And I boned up on the subject, feeling that the thing that was closest to their lives would be interesting to them. I hope you think this is funny. About the insurance agent who was bringing a check for $25,000 to the widow. Husband had passed on. While there, he decided he was going to try and sell her the very same policy. She thought a few minutes. She says, maybe I ought to take it because my husband was lucky with it. And you know, there are men in this world who live to beat insurance companies. They devote their lives to beating insurance companies out of large sums of money. And this is a man who's done that for 20 years. Never lost a case. A phony, a crook, and a thief. There wasn't a lawyer in the world that didn't know this guy was a crook, but they could never catch up with him. But now he's got the biggest case of his life. $250,000. They bring him into the courtroom on a stretcher. He's twisted up like a pretzel. They lift him off the stretcher, put him in the witness stand. The battery of defense attorneys try to break him down, and they can't move him. He knows the questions before they ask him. Shot. Well, he wins his case. Out in the corridor, after the trial is over, the attorney brings him a check for $250,000. He says, "We know you're a thief, a crook, and a phony. Here's your check. But I'm warning you, as of this minute, there'll be a man on your tail for the rest of your natural life. Till the day you die, he'll be with you. And the first day, and we know this will happen, the first day that your hand straightens out, mister, you not only lose the check, but you go to jail for the rest of your life." Well, he says, "That's interesting. It's been a rough week. Tell you what's going to happen. I'm going to stay home and rest up. And then one morning, a big limousine is coming. They're going to lift me into the limousine, drive me out to Kennedy Airport. A plane will be waiting. They'll lift me into the plane, fly me up to Montreal in Canada. They lift me out of the plane into a big limousine and drive me to the shrine of St. Anne de Beaupre. And if you happen to be standing there alongside of me, you're going to see the biggest damn miracle you ever saw in your life." I must tell you about a little couple, married well over 50 years, children all married off, well provided for. But now an anniversary is coming up. And the mother says, "You know, Arnie, we ought to have a union wife at a party, and we'll invite the kiddies. They'll bring presents. Like this, we'll enjoy." So it's arranged. That Saturday night, the doorbell rings, in comes the daughter with the son-in-law, the kiddies. "Oh, Daddy, I'm so sorry. You know, the baby wasn't feeling well, and I didn't get a chance to get downtown to buy you a gift." He said, "That's all right, sweetheart. You here. All right, hell with it. You here." 5 minutes later, in comes the eldest son, the doctor. "Gee, Dad, I hate myself. I was at the hospital all day, you know, with the operation. I didn't get a chance to buy you a gift. What are you wanting? You're my children. You here? You came? Who the hell with it? Don't worry." 5 minutes later, in comes the youngest. You know, with his wife and the kiddies. "Gee, Dad, you know, I was in court all day and I didn't, oh, look, we here, the whole family, to sit down to a fantastic meal Mom had been cooking all week." Now they get to the dessert and coffee. Papa stands up and he says, "Children, we here together. It's a happy occasion, but it is the truth. I must tell you that you live in Calais all the years. You mother and me, we never got married." The eldest son says, "Dad, you mean we're," he says, "uh-huh, and the cheapest." Speaking of mothers, yours as well as mine, unfortunately I lost mine some time back, but when this happened with my little mother, God rest her soul, I couldn't resist talking about it. Mama hadn't been well. My brothers and I tried to do as much for Mama as any one of you nice kids would like to do for yours. But you know, of course, that no matter what you do, it's always in the big boss's hands. Now, I have a particularly wonderful friend, a fellow I went to school with many, many years ago, and he loved my mother almost as much as he does his very own. Incidentally, this guy is loaded. But loaded. No inventory, just money. Kind of a guy who, when he sends roses, doesn't send just a dozen or two, he sends rooms full of roses. And he sent my mother a magnum of champagne and a bucket of imported caviar. And I know you folks are aware of the cost of those items. I had to go up to Boston for a couple of days, and when I got back, went up to visit with Mama. And among other things, I said, "Sweetheart, wasn't that nice of Jack? Did you enjoy them?" She says, "I tell you the truth. The ginger ale was wonderful. But the huckleberry jam tastes like herring." I want to favor the request of a lovely lady who took the trouble to call me upstairs. And I promised I would do it, and before I forget about it, I want to do the story about a woman who went to a portrait painter, a man of great reputation. She says, "I heard you are a very fine painter from pictures. I heard you practically the modern Picasso." You know, the painter. "I would like you should make me an oil." Oil. O-I-L, oil. She says, "Don't be with me fancy. If I ain't got dimples, don't put me. I don't want to look younger. I don't want to look older. Just see if you could capture the real me." Oh, he says, "That'll be quite simple." "Of course." "Well," she says, "it's nice to hear like this. Now, if you happen to have a little paint left over, is it possible you could paint me on both wrists gorgeous diamond bracelets with rubies and diamonds and hemels? Hemels. It's not a sickness, it's a gem. You'll make my necklace also with the rubies and the hemels and the diamonds, and for the hair a tarare." "Is that possible?" He says, "Of course, there'll be no problem with that. Why would you want that?" And she says, "Well, I'll tell you the truth. My husband is a louse. When I'll die, I'm sure the next week he's going to get married again. I want his next wife should drop dead looking for the jewelry." Any one of you would be reminded, as I was, of a story, because there is so much gin rummy played on the beach. Here are four men playing gin rummy. One loses $800 and drops dead right at the table. So out of respect to the deceased, they finish the game standing up. However, a situation presents itself. Somebody has to tell the wife. Nobody wants to, of course. So they draw lots. One fellow is selected and the other two say, "Please be careful and break the news. It's a serious," he says, "with me you ain't got with anything to worry. I'm a discreet boy." Goes over to the house, knocks on the door, walks in, he says, "Sweetie, your husband just lost $800 playing Jim Rome." She said, "He should drop dead." He says, "He did." Discretion. Let me tell you about one of the wealthiest men in the nation. Unfortunately, a widower, and yet possessed of a beautiful daughter. When his entire life revolved about her likes and dislikes, there was nothing in the world this girl couldn't have. He was taking her to Europe. They were aboard ship. It was the middle of the winter, stormy. While taking a turn about the deck for a breath of fresh air, suddenly the ship lurched and off into the water she went. Well, he simply went out of his mind. "Save my lovely daughter. I'll share my fortune with any man brave enough." In your lives, you've never heard such excitement. Pandemonium. Bells were clinging. The ship shuddered as a result of retarding and propellers. Then they went round and round in circles, and suddenly the cry was heard, "Man overboard!" They looked over into the water. He was a little old man in his 80s. Beautiful silver-gray beard floating upon the silvery waves, swimming toward the girl despite his many years with the strength of a Samson. He managed to reach her, then lift her to the deck, covered with blankets. "Now the rich man says there is nothing in the world you'll ever want for again as long as you live. I'm going to give you half of my fortune. You'll give $1 million to charity every year. So don't do me no favors. Happens I don't need no money. I got a chain 14 empty stores. Just answer me one question. Who pushed me?" I haven't done this in a long time, and I hope I remember it. It's about a couple getting ready to celebrate their 35th wedding anniversary. The husband comes home, as husbands will. And he says, "Sweetheart, for this 35th wedding anniversary, I'm going to show you a time that you never had it. Finest restaurants, best theaters, it's not a question." She says, "I'll be very happy to go with you. But on one condition, you got to buy me a low-cut gown of plunging. He says, a what? What the hell are you, a chippy? That's Western talk. He says, a special with your equipment yet? She says, I can't help it if I'm a healthy girl. Don't forget we had 6 children. And you was also involved. You with a big mouth. All my girlfriends is wearing plungers. And if you wouldn't buy me then the hell with it, you could enjoy yourself a union wife to me. But he'd always been a liberal husband, as most of you gentlemen are. He gave her the okay to buy it. She came home with a gown, folks, you and your lives have seen plunging necklines. This was at our diving. This was with a pubic exposed. Took her to Danny's Hideaway for dinner. During dinner, she says, Mars, I got a terrible odds bun. Says, you ain't got no odds bun, eat. She says, what are you making me to be crazy? If I say I got odds bun, I got odds bun. Says, you goddamn idiot. You ain't got no odds bun. Your left side is laying in the hot soup.